The Federal Reserve just delivered a rate cut, a highly anticipated 25 basis point move. We expected it, the markets braced for it, and yet, somehow, the actual announcement landed not as a relief, but as a kind of a stern warning.
Exactly.
This is the central paradox we have to unravel today.
Yeah.
Why would a major policy decision designed specifically to ease monetary conditions actually feel deeply hawkish?
It's the ultimate central banking tightrope walk. They call it the hawkish cut. They gave the market the action it desperately wanted today, the cut. But then, in the same breath, they just aggressively pulled back the future roadmap.
Mm-hmm.
That forward guidance, the caution about 2026, is what fundamentally changed the tenor of the day.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we are cracking open the sources surrounding the Federal Reserve's most recent decision, analyzing why this specific combination of action and signaling has created, well, more uncertainty than clarity on the path ahead for the economy and for investors.
Our mission is straightforward, but it requires some serious synthesis. We're going to unpack exactly what this 25 basis point cut means in the context of inflation that just won't go away.
Right.
We're synthesizing all this confusing, contradictory economic data, especially the signals in the labor market that seem to, you know, disagree with one another.
Yeah.
And crucially, we also have to analyze the profound, if subtle, significance of the official end of quantitative tightening. That's the other massive lever they control.
By the time we wrap up this deep dive, you should walk away with a crystal clear understanding of what this hawkish cut truly represents.
Yeah.
You'll know why the central bank is so deeply divided internally, that philosophical split is defining policy, and why the extreme data uncertainty defining the outlook for 2026 is, frankly, unprecedented in recent cycles.
Yeah, it's a confusing time.
Okay, let's unpack this. Yeah. So let's begin with the action itself, the core decision. The Fed moved the federal funds rate down by 25 basis points, shifting the target range into the 3.5% to 3.75% range.
Mm-hmm.
For most traders and sophisticated analysts, this was a largely priced-in event. It was anticipated, based on slowing growth forecasts and cooling, though still persistent, inflation.
The cut itself was almost procedural because the expectation was so high. But here's where it gets really interesting.
Right.
The Fed immediately coupled that dovish action, that actual lowering of rates, with an extraordinarily cautious signal regarding the entire future path of policy.
Yep.
They moved today, but they pushed back hard on the idea that this is the beginning of a rapid series of cuts. This is monetary policy messaging at its most nuanced and, you know, most confusing.
That signaling is the key to understanding the market's caution. When we look at the summary of economic projections, what people call the dot plot, the median forecast from policymakers showed only one single rate cut for the entirety of 2026.
Just one.
This projection is identical to the cautious outlook they gave back in September. The fact that they cut rates, only to immediately reiterate that same restricted outlook, fundamentally surprised and disappointed those analysts who were hoping for a rapid acceleration of easing next year.
It's a message that says, we moved only because the current data, despite its gaps, permitted this single small adjustment. Do not extrapolate this move into a trend.
Mm-hmm.
This caution is the pure definition of the hawkish cut. The Fed used the opportunity of the cut to aggressively manage or perhaps lower inflation expectations and just tamp down market enthusiasm for rapid easing over the next year or so.
Right.
They gave a small growth concession today, but they won the long game on tone.
And the reason that forward guidance is so vital is that it masks, or perhaps attempts to impose order on, the deeply unsettling internal division right now within the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC.
Oh, absolutely.
Historically, dissents among members were rare.
Yeah.
Central banking demanded consensus. They always presented a unified front to maximize the impact of their messaging.
Yeah, you wanted a single voice.
Now, the body is profoundly divided, and that split makes reading the market outlook incredibly difficult because you don't know whose camp will ultimately gain control.
And what's fascinating here is the texture, the ideology behind the disagreement. We saw three members specifically dissent from the 25 basis point decision.
Three is a lot.
It is. On one side, reflecting that deep-seated worry about inflation, you had Chicago Fed President Austin Goolsbee and Kansas City Fed President Jeffrey Schmidt.
The Hawks.
The Hawks. They both argued emphatically for no cut at all, reflecting their persistent concerns about sticky inflation that just will not fully fade back to target.
And their concern, based on what we see in the sources, isn't just about the current 3% inflation rate. It's about the structural risk of unanchored expectations.
That's the real bogeyman for a central banker.
It is. After 4.5 years above 2%, consumers and businesses might start to genuinely believe that 3% is the new normal. If that happens, the Fed loses credibility and fighting inflation becomes 10 times harder, maybe even requiring a destructive recession.
Right.
For Goolsbee and Schmid, preserving that long-term inflation anchor is worth sacrificing some short-term growth.
But then, pulling in the exact opposite direction, you had Fed Governor Steven Mnuchin, who argued for a bigger cut, maybe 50 basis points.
The dove.
Totally. His concern clearly centered on the slowing pace of growth, the lagging effects of all those previous aggressive hikes, and signals of potential weakness, particularly in sectors that are really sensitive to interest rates, like housing and manufacturing.
So he's looking at the other side of the mandate.
Exactly. He worried more about the risk of a policy-induced recession than he did about a marginal increase in inflation.
So you have this three-way split in the sources. Hold fast and wait for 2%. That's Goolsbee and Schmid. Cut a little to acknowledge the cooling, which is the center group, or cut a lot to avert a recession, Mnuchin's camp.
And that three-way split doesn't even tell the full story of the caution.
How so?
The source material highlights that six total members, a significant block, specifically penciled in no rate cut at all for this entire meeting. That means a substantial minority of the core policy setters believed the economy was simply not ready for any easing yet. This level of internal heat is unusual, and it tells you everything about the challenge of their dual mandate right now.
And this high degree of disagreement isn't accidental or personal. It directly stems from the challenges of setting policy in what is clearly a confusing, contradictory economy.
Mm-hmm.
The sources point to specific external and structural factors that are just blurring the market outlook, making consensus almost impossible to achieve.
We're talking about external shocks and unique structural shifts. There was the government shutdown that delayed critical data, a major problem we'll dive into next. But structurally, there's the ongoing impact of massive new fiscal policies, and perhaps most intriguing, a significant wave of investment driven by artificial intelligence.
That AI investment surge, specifically mentioned in the sources, is where the confusion about future growth potential really resides. For the economy, AI represents a massive structural shift in productivity.
It's a wild card.
It is. If businesses can suddenly produce significantly more goods or services with the same amount of labor, productivity goes up. And theoretically, you can sustain higher economic growth without fueling higher inflation.
Exactly. And this dynamic directly fuels the division. Mnuchin's camp might see this AI-driven investment as a sign of new, non-inflationary growth potential that justifies easing rates now.
Let's not choke off a boom.
Right. Why choke off a productivity boom just starting? But the Goolsbee-Schmid camp would counter that this investment wave creates massive, immediate demand for capital and resources. Think data centers, chips, power, which creates immediate overheating and inflation before the productivity benefits fully materialize.
It's a classic dilemma of timing.
It is.
How do you model growth or inflation when a new, poorly understood technological revolution is hitting the economy at the same time as the lagging effects of the highest interest rates in decades? It just creates a high signal-to-noise ratio.
Right.
You can't tell if the weakness is temporary cyclical slowing or if the strength is genuine structural non-inflationary growth.
So, to reiterate and synthesize that concept, the hawkish cut is a policy signal. The Fed took the dovish action of cutting rates, but spoke hawkishly, cautiously, and inflation-averse by pushing back so aggressively on future easing expectations.
And throughout the press conference, Chairman Jerome Powell maintained a remarkably consistent message, one focused entirely on maximizing optionality. He kept saying that the Fed is well-positioned to wait to see how the economy evolves.
Mm-hmm.
He basically admitted they're driving through a thick fog with a hesitant foot on the accelerator. They took their foot off the brake, but they have not committed to speeding up.
And he was incredibly careful not to commit to any move in January. He stated that the cut only happened because the economic data permitted it. That word, permitted, it suggests a policy choice made under duress. You know, a strict constraint, not an enthusiastic pivot toward long-term easing.
The immediate market reaction confirmed that cautious interpretation. Stocks closed higher relief rally because the expected cut happened, removing a major source of near-term uncertainty.
Right. The event risk was gone.
Exactly. Treasury yields, which move inversely to prices, moved lower, reflecting expectations of slightly slower growth and inflation in the medium term. And the dollar weakened. This all reflects analysts seeing the decision for what it was. cautious optimism, but severely tempered by the cautious outlook and all the uncertainty around 2026.
So this division is really the landscape. Given these conflicting views within the FOMC, from the three dissenters to the six members projecting no cut at all, how essential is patience right now to the Fed's long-term strategy, and does that patience come with a cost?
Patience is key, but if data stays murky, patience becomes paralysis.
Mm.
So move from the policy signal, the language in the split, to the actual foundation it was built upon, the economic data. This is where the story gets deeply concerning, because the Fed entered this meeting explicitly lacking its usual visibility into the economy.
They were, as you said, flying blind for a critical period. The source material points out that the government shutdown that ran from October into November significantly delayed several key data releases that the Fed relies on for its core indicators, specifically for inflation and employment.
Yeah, if you're a central bank, you rely on a continuous uninterrupted stream of up-to-the-minute reports like the Consumer Price Index, CPI, the Producer Price Index, PPI, and various regional manufacturing surveys.
All the big ones.
All of them. And having that flow disrupted forces them to make monumental policy decisions using old or stale information, often relying on proxies that have known historical shortcomings.
So when the CPI is missing, what specific internal survey are they forced to rely on, and what are the known shortcomings of that proxy data?
Well, the primary reliance shifts to private sector indicators, like the ISM surveys and anecdotal evidence compiled in the Beige Book, which is a collection of regional business reports.
So it's more qualitative.
Exactly. The flaw is that these are qualitative, not quantitative. They reflect sentiment, not hard prices or hiring numbers. That's a huge increase in risk.
Right.
Imagine being a pilot trying to navigate a complex landing approach using a cockpit display that's flashing two-month-old data and supplementary notes based on vague passenger sentiment.
Not a great feeling.
It dramatically increases the chance of misjudgment. And what this means for us, for you, is that we have to evaluate the 25 basis point decision through the lens of incomplete, delayed, and compromised information.
And what information they did have still showed the central existential problem. Inflation remains stubbornly above the Fed's long-term 2% target.
Still.
Specifically, the Consumer Price Index is running at 3% year-on-year, and we know from the sources that this rate has been creeping back up since May.
3% is already problematic, but here's the duration that truly fuels policymaker worry and the Goolsbee-Schmidt dissent. Inflation has now stayed above that 2% goal for 4.5 years straight.
Wow, 4.5 years.
That is a sustained failure to meet the mandate. If inflation stays elevated for this long, it starts to shift expectations. We start talking about inflation being structural, not temporary.
And that sustained pressure is the core concern about unanchored expectations. When inflation persists above target for that long, it starts to shift the psychological contract. People stop believing the Fed can or will hit 2%.
Right.
Businesses start baking 3% or 4% into their long-term contracts and wage negotiations. That behavior then becomes self-fulfilling, making the Fed's job exponentially harder.
And that fear, the fear of losing credibility, is why the Fed's own projections are so humble. They expect inflation to ease only gradually, reaching about 2.4% by the end of next year.
So they're not even promising a quick return.
No, I think we need to make a vulnerable admission here. I mean, it is incredibly difficult to set policy or make investment choices when core data sets offer such contradictory signals, especially when the central bank itself is operating on stale data.
Yeah, I still wrestle with it. It's like stacking Lego blocks of data, but half the blocks are missing and the other half don't quite fit together, leading to a structure that is fundamentally unsound.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
And it creates an enormous internal policy tension. Nowhere is that tension more obvious than in the labor market signals, which seem to be screaming two different messages at the same time.
Oh, the labor market is a total puzzle right now.
It is. We saw non-farm payrolls slow earlier in the summer, which might suggest weakening demand and a clear case for a rate cut. But then, in September, they rebounded sharply with a strong reading of plus 119,000 jobs, actually beating expectations.
Right, which looks robust and potentially inflationary.
But wait, the picture immediately gets blurred again by other data points. The source material highlights that more recent private data suggests general weakness. Critically, the unemployment rate ticked up, moving from 4.3% to 4.4% in September. And while that's a small jump, just 0.1%, it's movement in the direction of cooling, which Fed Governor Mirren would point to as clear justification for a deeper cut to prevent a major employment shock.
You're absolutely right. But then, to complete the contradictory trifecta, you have initial jobless claims, the number of people applying for unemployment benefits, which remain near multi-decade lows and have even fallen recently.
Yeah, that's the head-scratcher.
It is. Jobless claims are a critical measure because they indicate how many employers are actively firing people. Low claims suggest a tight labor market where employers are holding on to their workers, contradicting the rising unemployment rate.
So we have a synthesis problem here that the Fed had to resolve.
Sure.
How do you reconcile strong job creation numbers and low firings, which suggest tightness and resilience, with a ticking up of the unemployment rate, which suggests cooling?
This is where the synthesis becomes the core insight. The consensus seems to be forming around labor participation. If the unemployment rate ticks up slightly, not because of mass layoffs, which the jobless claims data contradicts, but because the higher wage environment is pulling people back into the labor force who had previously dropped out, like stay-at-home parents or early retirees, that's actually a hugely positive sign.
Oh, so a rise in unemployment driven by increased participation is the definition of a soft landing.
Pretty much.
It means the economy is resilient enough to absorb new workers without collapsing. It doesn't scream recession risk. It just suggests that the labor supply is finally catching up with demand.
Precisely. The data shows no labor market collapse and that resilience prevents deeper, aggressive cuts for the inflation hawks. But there is enough sluggishness and enough of a perceived slowdown, especially with the rising unemployment rate, however small, to justify that 25 basis point cut for the centrists.
It's a highly fragile equilibrium built on interpreting some really nuanced data.
It really is.
So if the Fed's own inflation projections are only 2.4% next year, after spending 4.5 years above 2%, is the 2% target even feasible in this timeline? Or are they implicitly accepting a new, higher average?
The Fed acknowledges that hitting 2% will be a very gradual process, signaling a long slog.
We focused heavily on the interest rate decision, the federal funds rate, which is the primary tool the Fed uses to manage the price of money.
Right, the main lever.
But the Fed has another equally massive lever, its balance sheet, which controls the quantity of money in the system, or liquidity. And a profound, if subtly communicated, shift just occurred here.
Absolutely. The Fed officially stopped quantitative tightening, or QT, on December 1st. This is a massive symbolic and technical shift. It officially ends the long active period where the Fed was deliberately shrinking its balance sheet, which meant actively pulling cash and liquidity out of the financial system.
For those of us who need a thorough refresher, let's deeply unpack these two core concepts because they are fundamental to understanding liquidity. When we talk about quantitative easing, QE, that's when the Fed expands its balance sheet by buying government bonds, treasuries, and mortgage-backed securities.
Right.
When the Fed buys those assets, it credits the seller's bank account with money, thereby injecting cash, or what we call reserves, directly into the banking system, increasing liquidity.
And quantitative tightening, QT, is just the inverse. The Fed shrinks the balance sheet by allowing the bonds it holds to mature without reinvesting the principal, or sometimes by actively selling them. This shrinking process pulls cash and liquidity bank reserves out of the system.
The extraction phase.
Exactly. It's designed to sop up all that excess liquidity created during the QE phase.
And we have historical evidence of the massive impact this balance sheet activity has on asset prices and inflation. The source material reminds us that from 2019 to 2022, when the Fed ran heavy QE, risk assets surged across the board, stocks hit record highs, crypto boomed, real estate went parabolic.
A wild time.
But when they shifted aggressively into QT starting in 2022, those same risk assets declined significantly as liquidity was drained.
So stopping QT is universally viewed as a positive signal for risk assets going forward because the active process of draining liquidity is finally over. The pressure is off.
Mm.
But this is not the end of the story. It's merely the beginning of the next phase, which requires immense technical understanding.
Right. Analysts now expect the balance sheet to begin growing again, albeit incredibly slowly. This growth is anticipated to start as early as the first quarter of 2026. The plan involves buying only small amounts of treasury bills with an anticipated growth rate of perhaps $20 billion per month.
And this is where the plumbing of the financial system comes into play.
Exactly.
To understand why they are doing this, we have to talk about the system open market account, or SOMA. The Fed uses the SOMA to manage its holdings. They need to ensure that the banking system always has an adequate level of reserves cash to facilitate daily transactions and maintain stability.
So it's about stability.
It is. If reserves drop too low, short-term funding markets, like the repo market, can seize up, which is a significant risk to financial stability.
So this slow $20 billion a month increase is necessary not to stimulate the economy, but purely to maintain an adequate buffer of bank reserves, thereby supporting the financial system's smooth functioning.
Right.
They're essentially topping up the reserves tank to keep the engine from stalling, which is fundamentally distinct from economic stimulus.
Whoa. Imagine the difference between the prior massive QE fire hose, which saw the balance sheet balloon by trillions of dollars in just a couple of years, and this slow $20 billion a month increase.
It's trickle.
It's a tiny, measured drip intended for liquidity maintenance compared to the aggressive, deliberate expansion designed to juice economic activity in past cycles. That sheer scale difference is the crucial concept to grasp.
And that scale difference is why the Fed was so explicit. They were clear that this slow, measured expansion is not quantitative easing.
They screamed it from the rooftops.
They did. They do not want the market to get ahead of itself, believing that the risk-on party is starting again. If the market perceived this as a return to active QE, it would immediately ignite inflationary expectations, potentially undoing all the difficult disinflationary work the rate hikes accomplished.
So the Fed is managing the banking system's plumbing, not actively stimulating demand. This distinction is critical for policy signaling and maintaining credibility with the inflation hawks.
But even a slow drip matters for market psychology. The source notes that even this technical expansion will be mildly positive for liquidity.
Right.
While not a market shaker overnight, over time, increased liquidity supports risk assets. Specifically, the source highlights assets like Bitcoin, which often benefit from even small expansions in financial system liquidity as more cash flows into the system.
And this balance sheet policy shift is happening at a time of extreme policy sensitivity. You have the internal division over the interest rate, limited visibility into the core economic data, and an upcoming leadership change that adds political uncertainty. Managing this delicate return to balance sheet growth, this slow drip of reserve replenishment, without setting off alarm bells in the inflation camp, requires immense precision.
So if this slow expansion is just technical maintenance and not QE, what's the core risk if they suddenly accelerate that $20 billion pace prematurely? Or if the market misinterprets their intent?
Speeding up expansion risks shattering the inflation anchor and triggering uncontrolled market euphoria, leading to a massive policy reversal.
We've analyzed the policy signal, the data constraints that made the decision so difficult, and the mechanics of the balance sheet shift. Now let's synthesize this complex picture. What does this mean for you, the learner, and the investor moving into 2026? What comes next?
Since the 25 basis point cut was already largely factored into asset prices, the real market reaction focused almost entirely on the tone and the guidance provided by Chairman Powell and the new FOMC projections.
Right.
This shift from focusing on action to focusing on tone is the hallmark of late stage cycles.
The immediate results were a classic mix of relief and cautious positioning. Stocks closed higher, Treasury yields moved lower across the curve, and the dollar weakened against other major currencies. This reflects a broad analytical consensus that while the Fed remains cautious, they've decisively signaled that the tightening phase of this cycle is over.
The problem isn't the December decision, which was largely benign. The risk resides entirely in the high-stakes meeting coming up in January.
Yeah.
Asset prices, especially in equity and credit markets, have moved almost perfectly in tandem with the expectations for a December cut. The market appears to be pricing in a series of cuts for the first half of next year.
But the Fed's own dot plot shows only one single cut for the entirety of 2026.
A huge disconnect.
It's a huge disconnect. Yeah. That mismatch between the market's aggressive expectations for easing and the Fed's official conservative guidance is the source of near-term volatility and risk.
Right.
If the Fed does not cut again in January, markets could react sharply to the disappointment, perceiving the Fed as having suddenly turned sharply hawkish again.
And that's the risk of getting too far ahead of the central bank. They have a history of correcting market overoptimism, often quite aggressively. For investors looking at the medium-term picture, the signals are still mixed, and we have to weigh history against current reality.
Historically, cutting rates when stock indices are near all-time highs has often been a decidedly bullish signal over the subsequent 6 to 12 months.
It can be, yeah.
It suggests the Fed is easing proactively, anticipating a soft landing and normalizing policy before a recession hits, rather than reacting desperately to an imminent crisis.
But that historical optimism, however, must be heavily tempered by the specific realities of today. We cannot ignore the Fed's extremely cautious guidance. Powell's consistent message of policy patience, and the deeply divided internal disagreement, which adds layers of geopolitical and policy uncertainty.
That's right.
The fact that Goolsbee and Schmidt are still vocally against easing prevents the central bank from moving quickly.
And it creates a situation where policy risk is amplified because the Fed has committed to being purely data dependent. But as we discussed, the data itself is lagging, contradictory, and often delayed by external shocks like government shutdowns.
Right.
This means markets are going to swing wildly with every single subsequent release, especially inflation and employment numbers.
So for the listener who wants to stay informed and ahead of the curve, what are the absolutely critical areas to watch over the coming months for guidance on that January decision?
Markets will be closely watching three key areas for the clearest signals. First, inflation updates, especially the core PCE measure, which the Fed prefers. Any sign that disinflation is stalling or reversing will stop the Fed cold.
Number one with a bullet. Second, labor data releases. We need clarity on whether the strong September payroll bounce was an anomaly or the start of a robust trend. Specifically, watch those initial jobless claims to confirm that employers are still not conducting mass layoffs.
And third, forthcoming balance sheet announcements. Any move to alter that measured $20 billion a month pace, either speeding it up or slowing it down, would signal a significant nonverbal policy shift regarding their assessment of financial system liquidity.
It all comes back to Powell's simple overarching strategy. Wait for the data and decide meeting by meeting. That extreme openness, that refusal to pre-commit, defines the coming months. It's a period of deep uncertainty where policy is being set in real time, relying on data that is often delayed and confusing.
So beyond the Fed's internal data flow, what external event, an unexpected economic or geopolitical shock, could suddenly force their hand before the next meeting, regardless of their planned caution?
A sudden, unexpected spike in the unemployment rate, suggesting mass layoff, would likely accelerate their next move dramatically.
We've covered a massive amount of ground here, synthesizing what was on the surface a simple rate decision, but which was underpinned by a fundamental tectonic shift in the long-term policy outlook.
The core insight for you, the learner, is this. The December cut confirmed market expectations and provided a small dose of relief, but the Fed immediately used that action to aggressively reset expectations lower for the entirety of 2026, insisting on extreme caution due to persistent inflation and internal division. They acted dovish, but spoke hawkish.
The key takeaway is the internal conflict, that deeply divided FOMC where six members still wanted no cut, and the commitment to slow, deliberate movement. This is happening even as the other massive lever, the balance sheet, begins its slow, measured crawl back toward expansion with that technical $20 billion per month drip designed to manage bank reserves, not stimulate the economy.
And this blend of dovish action and hawkish tone leaves the market with a persistent visibility problem, unable to fully trust the Fed's roadmap because the committee itself is fundamentally split.
And this leads us to our final provocative thought for you to consider. The Fed is committed to waiting for reliable data before committing to any future moves. But our sources highlighted that external factors, like the government shutdown, can delay or outright compromise that data visibility.
Right.
What happens if this visibility problem persists into Q1 2026, forcing the divided Federal Reserve to rely on stale, partial, or highly contradictory information for yet another critical market-moving decision?
That is the risk we are left to weigh.
We want to thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the Fed's complex landscape. Stay curious.
Keep digging.
We'll catch you on the next one.